Coming up on Fronteras, voter fraud has become a hot-button issue as the November election draws closer. But why does it have so many people up in arms?
Voter fraud exists. It's not a unicorn, but it's only slightly less rare than unicorns, basically.
A look at who's talking about election fraud and why. Also, 20 years after the U.S. signed a free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, some North American manufacturers are finding cross-border ties to be essential.
We in North America, Mexico, the United States, and Canada, instead of being competitors, we're really partners in the global economy.
The state of manufacturing on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among 7 public radio stations, and it's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. The United States has a long and checkered history when it comes to the ballot box. In the last several years, the issue of voter fraud has become a rallying cry in local, state, and national elections. But as Nick Blumberg reports in the first of two parts, questions remain on how widespread election fraud really is.
Every election season is full of robocalls from campaigns eager to get out the vote. Here's a recent one out of Arizona.
11 years ago today, we as Americans were united by the tragic events of 9/11.
The recording goes on to invite the listener to attend a local party meeting to memorialize the 9/11 attacks and...
We invite you to learn about how we can restore our republic by helping prevent voter fraud and educating voters about the representative candidates.
The candidate who paid for the call is Ray Speakman, running as a Republican for Arizona's State House. He says voter fraud is a bipartisan issue.
Fraud is taking place, the elections really can't speak to the voice of the people. That is our voice, and if there is voter fraud taking place, it hurts everybody.
It's hard to argue that fraudulent voting would harm the sanctity of elections, but is voter fraud actually happening?
I don't think it's a statistically large percentage problem in Arizona.
Ken Bennett is Arizona's Secretary of State.
Any amount of voter fraud is too much.
Bennett hasn't seen many cases since he took office in 2009, but Arizona cross-checks its ballots with 15 other states to make sure nobody votes in two places. Recently, Bennett held a press conference and announced 9 alleged new cases of double voting in 2008.
If it's a small amount, then maybe we're succeeding at preventing it from becoming a large amount.
Voter fraud exists. It's not a unicorn, but it's only slightly less rare than unicorns, basically.
Steve Doig teaches journalism at Arizona State University and works on a project called News 21. His student journalists compiled a database of voter fraud cases in the U.S. over the last 12 years. In that time, they found a little more than 2,000 alleged cases of fraud, just a handful in Arizona, and only 10 instances nationwide of voter impersonation, which voter ID laws try to prevent. Despite the scarcity of fraud, 2/3 of states have passed some kind of voter ID law, including Arizona. Doig says a lot of those laws come out of Republican legislatures.
Even in the face of arguments that there hasn't been a problem, Pennsylvania had a fascinating court case where they were arguing about it, and they actually had to stipulate at the beginning of it that, in fact, there hadn't been a single case that voter ID would stop, and then basically still went ahead with it anyway.
Pennsylvania's voter ID law, the subject of an ongoing legal battle, is considered among the strictest in the nation, and it got some negative buzz after a speech this summer by State Representative Mike Terzai.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania, done.
Statements like this have people worried that voter fraud prevention isn't aimed at criminals, but at disenfranchising minority, elderly, and low-income voters more likely to vote for a Democrat. Organizations like the ACLU, the Advancement Project, and the Brennan Center are sounding the alarm. In Arizona, a state that's been watched by the Justice Department for decades because of a history of discriminating against minority voters, groups are prepping an army of volunteers for an election that draws ever closer. In Phoenix, I'm Nick Blumberg.
A Pennsylvania judge recently blocked that state's voter ID law. And the National Republican Party fired an Arizona company that organized get-out-the-vote drives in swing states over suspicious registration forms. In the second of two parts, Nick Blumberg reports on who's trying to stop voter fraud and how they're doing it.
For a long time, the Republican National Committee engaged in election fraud prevention until 1982, when they were sued by the Democratic Party for targeting minorities in violation of the Voting Rights Act. The RNC signed an agreement that a federal judge has upheld through 2017, curbing its fraud prevention efforts. The absence of an official party apparatus has given rise in the last few years to independent Republican groups.
Hello, I'm Brad Zinn, co-founder and co-chair of Verify the Vote, Arizona Elections Task Force.
Verify the Vote is one such group. Its co-chairs repeatedly declined to be interviewed for this story, but a 20-minute video on their website lays out their goals. Brad Zinn, a Tea Partier, comedy magician, and reporter for the conservative news site Western Free Press, is co-chair of Verify the Vote, along with Jennifer Wright, a lawyer and former Tea Party candidate for Phoenix mayor.
In the last 4 years, we've all been made aware that there are forces at work to steal power from the people by manipulating the vote.
Wright never says who those forces are, but Verify the Vote outlines a few approaches to stop them. They want volunteers to review voter rolls and registrations, to monitor early ballot counts, and they encourage like-minded voter fraud hawks to get hired as poll workers. But by far, their biggest push is to train and deploy 5,000 poll observers across the state. In Arizona, political parties are entitled to one observer each at every polling place. Wright says while 80% of poll watchers will have a long, boring day,
upwards to 20% are going to find issues that, absent their presence, could have resulted in a fraudulent vote being cast.
It's not clear how she calculated that number, but issues around election fraud are often raised on both sides of the aisle without concrete evidence.
Yeah, that's the crux of the whole issue. It's a bunch of what-ifs.
Natasha Khan is an ASU grad student who's covered voting rights for the News 21 Project. She reported from the 2012 summit of True the Vote, a national voter fraud prevention group that inspired Verify the Vote and other offshoots in 32 states.
Nobody ever actually said that they had ever seen in person somebody committing election fraud that I spoke with. You know, it was just a lot of anecdotal, like, well, I know in my county there are illegal immigrants voting. Okay, how do you know that?
Stories about busloads of ineligible voters have circulated widely. Though reports of fraud often go unconfirmed, fraud prevention activists say poll watchers are essential. Brad Zinn from Verify the Vote says it's impossible to prove a negative.
So we can't tell you what won't happen if you are there, or what you might have prevented from happening if you're there. However, we can pretty much assure you that if you're not there, those that wish to unfairly influence the election by fraud or deceit will be doing their best to steal power through the ballot box.
Meanwhile, fraud prevention groups are providing motivation for Democrats, including Joaquin Rios, research director for the Arizona Democratic Party.
I'm not sure exactly what this organization is planning to do or whether they're planning on challenging the eligibility of voters on a widespread scale. We have seen that in other parts of the country in the past. And if they do that, then we're going to be prepared.
Rios wants to make sure voters know they can't be turned away from a polling place and that they can cast a provisional ballot if their name doesn't show up on the list.
We're going to be recruiting attorneys from all across Arizona who are going to be on call on election day to deal with any incidents of voter intimidation or any efforts by any individuals to try and discourage voter turnout or to try and suppress the vote.
But Verify the Vote doesn't think it's suppressing any legitimate voters. They see poll watchers as upholding the founding principles of the United States.
One day when your children or grandchildren ask you, where were you when America needed you? You'll be able to answer them, I was there. I answered the call of liberty on Election Day 2012.
But in this fight, liberty is in the eye of the beholder. In Phoenix, I'm Nick Blumberg.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. Some North American manufacturers are finding cross-border ties to be essential.
We in North America, Mexico, the United States, and Canada, instead of being competitors, we're really partners in the global economy.
The state of manufacturing on both sides of the border. That's next on Fronteras. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. These days, some 6 million American jobs actually depend in some way on trade with Mexico. That's according to the Woodrow Wilson Center's Mexico Institute. In part six of our Fronteras Desk series, NAFTA 20 Years Later, Jude Joffe Block reports on the complex collaborations between manufacturers on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border.
Like most Americans, Bill Jordan drives to work. But unlike most, his commute involves an international border crossing.
Well, we're crossing over here, and as we come across into the border itself of Mexico, so where the blue signs are.
We're in Jordan's car, crossing from Calexico in southeastern California into Mexicali, which he does most days. He comes to supervise a manufacturing plant here for his employer, a small Phoenix-based company called Allied Tool and Die that makes niche aerospace parts.
So now we're in Mexicali itself, and this is the old part of downtown.
Jordan is just one commuter, but he's part of a long line of U.S. manufacturers who have made this trek south. Since NAFTA took effect, big multinational companies like Ford, General Electric, and Honeywell have expanded their operations in Mexico, in some instances displacing U.S. jobs along the way. Jordan's company followed Honeywell, their biggest customer.
We visited them here in Mexicali. They have a plant. We chose a batch of part numbers and says, we will make these in Mexico for you.
2 years ago, Jordan opened the new shop. It allows his company to make a few parts more cheaply. The goal is to keep employing 100 people in Phoenix. As the company expanded south, it also upgraded machinery in Phoenix so workers there can make more sophisticated parts. Here in the Mexicali plant, Jordan has just 3 Mexican employees. They're skilled workers and man huge computer-controlled machines, but earn a third to a quarter of what their American counterparts make.
That's a press going up and down. It's forming a little piece that will go into the assembly of a jet engine.
Before that, these pieces will travel north to an Arizona company for processing and then cross back to Mexicali to be installed into a Honeywell airplane engine system. They'll travel again before they're put in a plane. Because all the parts are North American materials, there are no tariffs. Michael Comunias of the U.S. Department of Commerce says NAFTA has helped grow these highly integrated supply chains.
You'll see products that cross the border 3 and 4 times or more en route to final production because there's a value-added component happening on both sides of the border. It's a synergistic relationship that benefits both countries.
In the last few decades, China's low wages and costs drew thousands of manufacturers away from North America. But now some companies are returning to the continent. If not to the U.S., then to Mexico.
Mexico is moving up the value-added chain.
That's Chris Wilson with the Woodrow Wilson Center's Mexico Institute.
We're now seeing growth in sectors like the automotive industry and aerospace. These are things that require a greater amount of skill, a greater number of engineers.
The number of aerospace jobs supplying the global industry has tripled in Mexico in the past 6 years. And Wilson says that growth benefits the entire continent.
The reality is that we in North America, Mexico, the United States, and Canada included, are all competing together as one economic unit. And so instead of being competitors, we're really partners in the global economy.
Partners certainly sounds great to Arizona businessman Bill Jordan. Back in Mexicali, he says that's exactly why his company is trying to expand south of the border, to keep the Phoenix plant in business.
So that supply chain stays here, so we can go back and forth with companies in the U.S. rather than seeing it leave this side of the world and go over to Europe or go over to Asia. Let's try to keep it here on our continent within the NAFTA.
That's the common manufacturing mantra you hear these days all along the border. There's a lot of boosterism going on. But global manufacturing trends can change quickly. Shifts in exchange rates or intensified violence in Mexico or even some other global event we can't begin to predict could disrupt all this. But for now, Jordan has room to grow and is looking for more aerospace clients. Reporting from Mexicali, I'm Jude Jaffe Block.
Maria Berriozabal is a transitional individual for San Antonio. She was the first Latina elected to city council, serving from 1981 to 91, and then very nearly was elected mayor of San Antonio in 1991. No longer in public office, Berriozabal can be called a controversial figure, a newsmaker, and a role model for future generations of Latinas looking to shape public policy and take a stand in the public square for social justice. Berriozabal explains how a studious and quiet girl from San Antonio's west side grew up to take on the city's power brokers in her memoir, Maria, Daughter of Immigrants. She spoke to Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies.
When I left public office in 1991, after I ran for mayor and lost, I was given a fellowship at Harvard University, and I spent a semester there with some wonderful students. And my job at Harvard, at the Institute of Politics, was to talk about my 10 years on city council, talk about public service. The Kennedy family had created that institute to inspire undergraduates to go into public service. And what happened there is that in discussing my work, my different campaigns and so on with my students, I found that they were so interested in what I had done and how I had done it. And they really had me appreciate my work in a way that I had never appreciated it before. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to write a book about my public service, my 10 years of public service on the city council, my campaign for mayor, the people I met, what I did, and what I saw in my city.
When you ran for city council, you won city council, you became the first Latina on city council for a major American city. And how did that make a big difference in the goings-ons in San Antonio?
I have to look at it, first of all, you know, history has to decide how other people see it or saw it. I look at how I saw it, and for me, it was work. Because I think a lot of people, particularly women, particularly Mexican-American women, who were the largest group of people that I served, I think they felt an affinity, which meant that I had a lot of work. I had a lot of people to come and ask me for help, a lot of people to support me, too. But those first years, what I remember is that the newness was in people just being proud, people inviting me to speak, people giving me awards, people just being really happy that I was there. And that's really the first thing I noticed. But so what I did, I just started working. I just started representing the people that I was elected to represent. And it's in very mundane, very ordinary, very regular ways. You know, what do the people need in their neighborhoods? The garbage and the dogs and the neighbors that can't get along with each other and the housing and how are we going to keep it up? So to me, you know, I was real focused on the work I was doing. And it turned out that most of the people I represented were working class and poor people. So that's where my heart went and that's where my issues went.
Before you got involved in politics, you worked as a secretary for the Salvation Army in the 1960s. You write about an episode that happened to you when you were being taken to lunch at Josky's and at a fashionable cafe downtown, and they turned you away because of racial prejudice.
That was traumatic, but interestingly to me, and I guess I've never forgotten that, is we used to go every Friday with the ladies of the staff. And they were all Anglo ladies. And so we went into the Camellia Room, it was called, very elegant. And they let my two colleagues go in, and then they put a rope in front of me. And I remember my heart sinking to my feet. That had never happened to me. And I looked at my boss's wife and my fellow worker, like, help. And they said very kindly to the lady, she's with us. Oh, and the lady removed the rope and I went in. So I was shocked. It was a terrible experience. However, the worst experience as I share in the book, is that I walked in. And that was when the African-American community were trying to integrate the counters and restaurants in San Antonio. And I felt that I had betrayed them. I felt like I had crossed the picket line, so to speak. And I think that's why I include that little story. It's one, it was discrimination against myself, but worse was how I responded.
If you tell that story to some of the youth today, they're not going to believe it. A lot of the Mexican-American youth today don't understand that that level of prejudice existed in San Antonio.
That's true. That's true. We have moved a lot. But I think there's always that in society. It's going to take a long time before we really remove all the vestiges. There used to be signs on the bus that said colored only in the back seats. And there were water fountains at Crest on Houston Street where my father would take us that said whites on one and colored on the other. That was the world I grew up in. And yes, we have to remember. And that's why I write those stories.
And so you got to drink from the white fountain.
I would go drink in both because we had heard when we were growing up, my parents would tell us stories of growing up in Lockhart, Texas, and the discrimination and the racism where the sign said no dogs, no Mexicans allowed. When my brothers and I saw the sign on the back of the bus that said colored only, we'd run to the back and we'd sit in the back and my father would go with us. It was our way of saying, this is wrong and we're going to break this law.
Former San Antonio City Councilwoman Maria Berriozabal has written a memoir called Maria, Daughter of Immigrants. It's published by Wings Press. Berriozabal will have a reading at the Esperanza Peace and Justice Center Friday at 7 p.m. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversation and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.